Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens, and unfortunately, Kathleen can't be with us today. But we have a very special guest for you today, and his name is Gary Evans. Now, Gary is a person who you may have seen. He is that man who quite often is in the room or helps people, and that is because he helps a number of people, including the likes of Robert Bovell, Graham Hancock, but many, many more. And this is why you may have recognized him. But I am very happy to say that Gary is stepping out of the shadows and talking about his own research, which is fascinating, and it involves acoustics. So first of all, Gary, welcome to the Spirit Revolution.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, Philip. It's good to talk to you today.
I've kind of as an introduction, because you are one of those people who always pops around everywhere, and you are a person who helps people, in specifically the alternative, getting their message out. How did you start doing that aspect of your
work? Yeah, that's a good question. It's certainly very enjoyable work. Well, there was a sort of dramatic shift in my life in 2009, and I could really attribute the turning point from what I would call my old corporate life to the new alternative work that I've been doing, to yoga. I went to a yoga class and managed to find a yoga teacher that didn't just concentrate on the physical aspects, but also integrated the more what we would call spiritual aspects and the understanding of tuning into the body and looking within. And that really sort of started me on the quest of looking inside myself as well as outside for some answers. And I sort of started off as a web designer for various conferences around the UK, working on the Stars and Stones conference with the late John Agnew. And also that's where I met Hugh Newman, who runs Megalithomania, who was certainly a big inspiration in the early days, seeing his dedication and the amount of energy it went into putting the conferences on. I learned a lot from watching him. And then from attending the Megalithomania conference and getting friendly with Hugh, I suddenly started talking to all of the authors that I'd been admiring and been able to talk with them directly about all the subjects that have been fascinating me since I started reading back in sort of at the age of 17, 20 or so years ago. So it's been quite a lot of fun recently.
Indeed, because this work which you're doing today brings you in contact with so many people, brings you across the world.
Yeah.
And how is your impression of the alternative? You, I'm always fascinated because you and I operate in this field in a way, I think, which is different from various other people's, in the sense that this is our world. And you kind of have come into this world recently. And I'm always fascinated by I wouldn't say outsiders, but by people coming into this world and kind of like seeing how it works. What is your impression of the alternative from an outsider coming in? Is it a surprise? Do you feel that we are moving into times of times which are shifting? And to some extent, you might attribute your own shift into this world as further evidence of this.
Yeah.
How do you see this?
Well, actually, I get a very good perspective because my daily job is talking to tour operators of sacred sites, radio show hosts, TV producers, conference organisers, all across the planet. So it's not only getting a perspective on one country. I'm now building up a picture of what's happening across the world. And also, I do get to talk to quite a few people that have been in various different aspects of the alternative world for quite a while. So I'm always keen to ask them, is there really a sort of tangible change happening now, or is this the way things always are? We think there's something better happening, and that's just the sort of status quo. Pretty much everybody that I've asked that's been around perhaps since the 60s or 70s definitely feels that there's a noticeable momentum growing. So I've taken that as an encouraging sign. And I do spend a lot of time working in the US and the UK, so that's very easy for me to draw comparisons between those two markets in particular, but also because I've got a lot of connections across Europe. So it's comparing the UK's sort of alternative community. And we do get a lot of people coming across to conferences in the UK from most of the countries in Europe. So I would certainly say that we're one of the sort of shining lights, but significantly behind the US. There's definitely a lot more going on in the US, and I do feel that the US is leading the way, and so I see a lot of positive to take from that.
Well, that is absolutely encouraging, I think, for many Americans who are actually quite often despairing of the state of their country. But yes, overall, I would agree with you that that this is where I would actually add maybe the number one contender actually being Australia.
Uh-huh.
Where at conferences in Australia, I must say the most intelligent questions I've ever been confronted with were asked at conferences in Australia. But we're not here to do some kind of alternative song contest or idol contest. Really, what fascinates me, Gary, is the fact that on all of these trips which you do, you're concentrating on something which very few people are concentrating upon. And it is also, what I like about it is the fact that you approach it slightly differently, and that is acoustics. Because apart from Paul Devereaux, I think there is hardly anybody out there who is really focusing on this. And Paul did this about a decade ago.
Yeah.
And did it very much in a, what I would call, technical, instrumental, very, let's try and show something to science that there is something to this. Whereas you, you don't bypass this, but you definitely say, I don't need all of these things to actually find out certain initial things. And a few months ago, you went, I believe, with Robert Bovell, to Egypt, and you basically entered pyramids and you began to do some experiments there. And uh-huh. I think that's kind of like a nice introduction to set up what kind of work you actually do and sort of the conclusions you reach.
Yes, yeah, that's a good introduction. I've met Paul Devereaux a couple of times and had some chats with him at conferences. So he certainly approaches the subject from the left-brained side, I would say. And because he certainly does a very scholarly approach and has a good magazine from that perspective. The sound side of my own research actually started in 2011. I've been to Egypt with Robert Bovell three times in the past 2 years. The first time to Egypt, I would say, was my kind of grounding. Okay, this is what I've been looking at for all these years. I'm finally here. And there's just so many different pyramids and different temples, and you want photographs of everything. So the first trip was more of getting the sort of lay of the land, the more interesting sites for me personally. And then the second trip was entirely different to that. The second trip was far more of a kind of, you could say, spiritual journey, or my understanding grew to entirely new levels that I wasn't even aware were possible at the time. And it's nice to share these experiences with similar-minded people, because what I'm very conscious of is that when you get interested in these subjects, you can come a bit ungrounded and just sort of drift off without anything tangible behind what you're looking at. But I'm the reason I work with all of these amazing people is because they inspire me, and I know that there's some real mysteries in the world. I don't need to make the mysteries up. There's some real tangible mysteries that are fascinating to me. So I'm in the search of truth as I know it, I would say. That's all we can ever try to find. So there needs to be something concrete to back up these experiences. And one way I like to approach that is this experience I'm having something that I can share with other people at the time? And then it's not just all in Gary's head. So it goes, we have to go back to yoga class once again, because when we're talking about sound use at megalithic sites, we would have to call, most people would know it as chanting. I prefer to call it toning. And that subject has got quite a few different connotations in different people's minds. So there's not any religious activities or anything tied into it. It's purely the body producing sound of megaliths. That's all that we're talking about doing here. But in the yoga class, when I first started chanting, in the Western world, we're not really used to doing this kind of thing in public. So there's definitely an uneasy feeling, which I now recognise in other people. It does make a lot of people a bit uncomfortable. But as I've been doing yoga 3 years now, I gradually got a little bit more used to it. And it's always nice if somebody else starts toning in the yoga class, and then you can just sort of start quietly at the back and blend into the crowd. That was how I started. But in this particular class, the teacher had got us toning this one tone for 10 minutes over and over and over. And I could feel a sort of small vibration in my body. So where I was producing the sound, I was moving this vibration up and down. It was just a sort of instinctive thing. And suddenly I found this point where if I produced the sound, the whole top of my mouth, and there was like a vibration going down the whole of my spinal column. And it was the most unnerving experience because I didn't know anything about it. And I went up to the yoga teacher at the end of the class and I said, I had this very strange experience, expecting her to know the answer of what had happened, and it was news to her as well. And that was kind of the end of it at the time. And then I went to Egypt, and before the tour with Robert, I met up with a couple of good Egyptian friends that take me out to various sites looking at the mysteries out there. And we ended up in the Great Pyramid in the King's Chamber, which is just incredible. I'd certainly recommend anyone that feels a calling to Egypt and the Great Pyramid in particular to try and get there when they can, because it's certainly a mysterious room. And so I found myself in the box in there. And the first thing my friend said to me was, please don't call it a sarcophagus. We call this a resonance box. So that was probably where the connection to sound and the King's Chamber came from. So I clambered inside the box. And as I was starting to tone, which they encouraged me to do, I thought back to this moment in the yoga class and wondered, well, what happens if I kind of vibrate my whole body while I'm inside this box? What would the effect be? And, well, I wasn't quite expecting the effects that happened. And at the time, my friends were standing around toning with me, and gradually they fell silent. So I gathered they were listening to me inside the box. And apparently, when I got out, they all had the kind of deer caught in the headlights expression in their eyes. And they said, when you're inside the box, the whole of the King's Chamber started to vibrate. And it was an amazing effect. And because I was admiring these people, because they were sharing so much with me, for me to have impressed them, I took a lot from that. And then during the course of the tour, other interesting things happened. And that was where the real interest in sound at megalithic sites comes from.
Do go on.
Well, that was the basis of it. There's been quite a few experiences since that time. Another really profound moment was a site. I went to Peru at the end of last year and was touring around with Brian Forster. And we ended up at Moray, which is Moray. And even getting there was quite the experience. We were in this little van. You have to go far off of the normal road, so it's quite a tight and twisty track climbing up into the Andes, and a sheer drop off the side of the road. And I was just staring out the window, admiring the snow-capped mountains in the distance. And they're just incredible. It's worth going to Peru just to look at the Andes, I would say, without any of the megalithic sites. And so we gradually climbed up to Moray, and it's sort of three separate sites, although they're probably connected in some way that we're not aware of. Concentric circles, and the biggest one, so my sort of best estimate would be is about 20 to 30 feet across in the bottom layer, but there's about 14 different levels of these circles gradually getting wider and wider and wider, and it's probably about 400 feet or so across at the highest level. And they've done it in a very ingenious way. Each level's a terrace, and they've just stuck in a bit of rock for a step. So you have to step down sort of about 3 feet each time, and there's two steps per level. So you're coming down quite a long way right into the bottom of it. Hopefully that's drawn some kind of a picture. Otherwise, it's best to look up Moray, Peru on the internet if you're listening. I was in the bottom center section with two of my friends that were in the group, and we were talking, and I could hear the sound resonance of our voices bouncing from side to side in the structure. But there was some European people about 12 levels above us and probably about 100 feet higher or so, and their voice was amplified far more than our voice was amplified at the bottom. And my a friend was with me, and she knew that I like to do toning at these sites, and she said, "Oh, Gary, you've got to go up to where they are and see what happens when you do your toning." So we clambered up about 12 of these levels, and so I started toning. But you have to find the resonance. You're not just doing any kind of random tone. These sites respond to a certain frequency, so if you want to interact with them, you've got to modulate your own frequency to get the kind of feedback. You will know it as soon as you've hit it, because you get an instant feedback effect. And in the King's Chamber, for instance, is a very low, deep tone, really gets that one resonating well. But this site was a much higher, what I would call a feminine frequency. And in fact, it was on the edge of my vocal range. And as I went up higher and higher and higher, suddenly found this pitch where I was getting the feedback, and so I started to get louder and louder, and the effect was getting more and more powerful. And I stopped for a moment, and my friend said, "Oh, aren't you going to strain your voice?" And I said, no, I'm okay, and then proceeded to tone again. And it got to such a point with the toning, because I was actually starting to feel energy from the site coming in to my body, which was a surprise. And so I continued doing what I was doing. So it does actually take quite a lot of energy in your body to generate sound. It gets tiring after a while. But with this particular instance, I was getting more energy from the site coming into my body, which was then producing an even louder sound. And it got to the point where there was so much energy coming into my body that I just let go of the kind of left-brained side of me that was creating the sound, and let the energy that I could feel coming into my body just take over and create the sound that the site seemed to resonate to. And so I took that as a big sign to just be when you visit megalithic sites. Don't visit them with too many preconceptions. Just see what you can feel there, and perhaps you'll discover something completely different to what you were expecting. So it was quite an interesting experience, to say the least.
And I think so many of us visit these sites in utter silence, or as you were saying early on, when you go to a site for the first time, the only sound you hear is quite often the clicking, whether electronic or manual, of cameras. Mm. And we are quiet, or we just listen to somebody give a lecture. And quite often in some of these sites over headphones. And even in like the beautiful Gothic cathedrals of Europe, it is so rare to hear singing. In fact, one of the things which I like about whenever we're in taking our tours around France, we go to various churches, but in Carcassonne there quite often is, I think it's at 11 o'clock in the morning, a group of three men who come and sing there for a few minutes, and sometimes it's an advertisement for please come and hear us sing later at night in right. Somewhere else. Yeah. But you know, to hear a church where it is, where people are singing, and you know, in this case, men singing, and quite a few of these churches were designed with the sound of men in mind, just makes the church come alive. It is so much more magical. You know, whatever is being sung just livens up that church. But what you are also highlighting, I think, is that this emphasis on acoustics, which so few people are underlining, yet is such an important part to our ancient monuments, is pretty much a global phenomenon. Egypt, you briefly touched upon megaliths, but I believe you've got some more examples from megalithic sites. Peru, where else have you come across indications, or have you done experiments of your own with sound?
Well, I should probably say it's got to the point now where when I visit a megalithic site, I'm looking for what I would recognise as an active site. So if there's just a wall left of something, then it's going to be pretty difficult for me to do anything with that. But the more intact the structure is to its possible original or sort of last incarnation, then that's the better, because we might still be able to have some kind of acoustic effects. And it's fair to say Egypt is the real jewel in the crown for that, because a lot of the sites are still so intact, even if some of them have been repaired with a little bit of concrete and things in places, there's still definitely a tangible effect. So I'm visiting ancient sites, looking for what I can discern as somewhere that's still got some of its original purpose and functionality in place, and then trying to see what kind of effect it has on my consciousness. Because you can go into some of these sites in one state of mind and leave in a very different state of mind. And I think this is part of the reason why so many people are called to these places, and quite often it can be a subconscious thing. We just feel happy. We feel happy around these sites. Perhaps we don't always know why, but we like to visit them. Whereas I'm kind of looking at it more from the conscious angle, and it's like anything. The more you visit, the more you practice these things, the easier it becomes to recognise a few things. And I certainly wouldn't say that I know all the answers. And in fact, I think knowing all the answers would be a bit boring, because finding out new things is a lot of fun. So I think there's certainly a lot more to come from this subject. And I'm always very keen on collaboration as well. I don't think it needs to be one person that has all the answers. But if I could inspire someone to look at something in a different way, and then they solved part of the puzzle, that's the only real reason that I'm starting to talk out about these subjects, to try and get a sort of healthy debate going on and move us forward a bit, perhaps towards a greater understanding of the past. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from. The most surprising sight that happened was I returned from Peru, and I've got a very good author and client friend, Maria Wheatley, who's been leading tours to Stonehenge and Avebury for 20 plus years. Her father was also a master dowser, so she was inspired with earth energy dowsing and leading tours to sites from a very early age. So she's got a huge amount of research that was passed on to her from him, and she's continued in his line. And whenever I visit her, I mean, she's got some of the most amazing information. She pulls out all these documents that are sort of 200-300 years old. And we were able to go back to some of the earliest drawings of the Avebury and Stonehenge environs, because a lot, sadly, has changed. A lot of megalithic sites have been, they call it field clearance. So they move the megaliths to the side of the fields, or they're just broken up and put into buildings. So we need to try and go back to those early drawings, because it gives us a better understanding of what the landscape was like. Because I can see that some of these megalithic sites are probably interacting with different elements of the landscape and other sites. I don't think necessarily we're trying to sometimes solve the mystery of the Great Pyramid in isolation, but I would rather say the Great Pyramid is a capacitor on a circuit board, and we're trying to work out what the circuit board does by looking at a capacitor. Well, you wouldn't by looking at it in that way. So we need to look at it in a more sort of holistic, grander way. And so that's another approach that I've been developing with her. And so we visited Avebury, which is always very nice. There's some nice pokey places there still. And she normally teaches me a bit about Earth Energy's dowsing. And West Kennet Long Barrow, which is next to Silbury Hill, the largest man-made mound in Europe, which is just round the corner. And then she said, oh, well, why don't we go see this dolmen that's just on the way back? And I visited a dolmen in 2011 with megalithomania, and we found some acoustic properties. So I'm always keen to go and have a look at dolmens, so I took her up on the offer. And we arrived at this site after a muddy trek up a lane for about 10 minutes, because it's not very often visited, this place. And in front of us was quite a substantial dolmen, three megaliths. So you've got two megaliths stuck into the ground with a megalith across the top. That's a sort of dolmen. Sadly, it sort of slumped a bit, so they've had to prop one of the megaliths up with a bit of concrete, but it's fairly intact. And it's about 5 feet high, and the capstone, the megalith across the top's probably about 10 feet wide and perhaps 7 or 8 feet wide. So it's a fairly substantial block. And so we sat inside it. We were just sort of admiring the beauty of the landscapes. It's nice and peaceful there. And I looked up into the megalith that was above us, and it looked like there was a hole in it. And I asked her, I said, Maria, what's that hole in the capstone? And she said, oh, I've never noticed that before. And the more I looked at it, the more it looked like it was the shape of a head. I thought, well, that's strange. And I had one of my Bolivian hooded tops on from the alpaca wool that I recently got in Bolivia. So I put my hood on and stuck my head in the hole. And it was almost perfectly head-shaped. I don't think I could have done a better job. The sides of this hole are rounded, so it's not like we've got jagged holes that somehow a bit of damage has happened or something. It wasn't like that at all. When you stick your head inside, it's just a bit deeper so that it's below your chin. So you can put your whole head inside. And I was looking at it, I was thinking, well, this is very strange. So I started a bit of toning, and the resonance coming off of it, Maria said, was very impressive. But if you've got your head inside a megalith creating sound, then you've got quite a few intense sound waves coming straight into your head. And so that was quite interesting. And we left feeling a lot happier than we'd entered the site. That was the sort of main important note to take account of. And it really does tie in, I think, quite nicely to something called gong baths. I'm not sure if your listeners are aware of what that is. But
by all means, explain.
Well, a gong bath is one of those large, well, it can be large gongs or smaller gongs that you hit with a hammer and you get the boo effect. And this is something that people use at festivals and yoga and places around the UK and the US. I found a nice one in Long Beach when I was at a conference. And what they generally do is they surround you with two or three different gongs and then hit them. And the sound waves are supposed to be a way of cleansing, I should guess, the energetic body, because this is basically where we're heading with these discussions about the megalithic sites, because I have reached a few conclusions, because it's given me a lot to think about. So a gong bath's always an interesting experience. If you do notice one, I'd recommend people just sitting down and experiencing it, because you're more than likely going to feel very light and much sort of happier, you could say, afterwards. So I think the effects that you can reproduce at megalithic sites is a similar kind of effect to gong baths and various different forms of sound healing, because there's quite an industry that's set up just around sound healing now. There's all different kinds of modalities that you can look into. So I left this site, and I decided I wanted to return to this dolmen because it was such a strange experience, and it's quite local to me. I do visit Maria quite often because I'm only about an hour and a half from Avebury, because I wanted to see, first of all, the effects that we felt that time, could we reproduce them? And I also wanted to go back and examine the hole, because I tried to take some photographs of it, but they hadn't come out very clearly. So I returned with Maria and another lady who I called my experiment. Can we also affect somebody else, or is it just me and Maria that are kind of having this effect from the site? So she came along as the control group, we could say. And we went back, and when I looked at the capstone of this dolmen, it was dead centre in the capstone. So that was another kind of a good sign for me, I thought. From all four directions, it was dead centre in the megalith. The shape of it is very nicely rounded, so it doesn't look like it's damaged. So it certainly looks like it was purposefully done. And in between our first and second visit, Maria had gone back to some of her old drawings of the area from some of the antiquarians, and she'd found out that there used to be four dolmens running up this valley. And that gave us a few things to think about, because if there was four different dolmens all running up this valley, which seems to have some good acoustics to it just by itself, what were these other dolmens like? But unfortunately, because they've gone, we perhaps will never know. There was a few megaliths that have been cleared, and I had a good study of those, but didn't look like there was sort of anything big enough for a capstone. So that's about as far as that research has gone for the minute in that area.
And it really is ongoing research. It's something which you're exploring, but it's also part of a larger, I think, you know, initiation kind of tradition, which Kathleen definitely stumbled upon when she visited Egypt about two decades ago, and she was with her friend taken along by a person who was local, a man who lived by the name of Fox, who you know, took people on site after hours, before there were walls around the complexes, and basically gave them a piece of what I would say the real magic of the Giza Plateau, and before he led them into the satellite pyramid of the Giza complex, he began to chant as well, and basically both Kathleen and her friend saw the walls beginning to move, that his voice really had this effect on the environment. And that is something which you don't really read that much about, in the sense that when you read accounts, whether they are from Mexico, whether they are from other places, you quite often read about visual effects, people having visual experiences, but the acoustic experience seems to be missing an awful lot, and yet it quite often is, if not in most cases, more powerful than the visual experiences. Is there a specific reason why we are, pardon the pun, blind to sound?
That very question is what I've been wondering about, is why can't I find a lot of research about this subject, and how is it that I'm kind of making a few discoveries or having to find my own way, because there's not a huge amount to fall back on. But that's fine. I'm quite happy with my little area. And in fact, when I started visiting these sites, as I did with my PR company working with the authors, I did set the intention of trying to inspire people in a new way, and just sort of left myself open to following the signs that crop up and trying to read them as best I can to have something of value to speak about. And as my understanding unfolds more, it does give me, I think, a slightly better perspective to be able to know who I should be working with, and also knowing who inspires me. If they inspire me, then I like to work with the people, because I think that's the best way to gauge any clients, rather than just basing my clients on a sort of financial system, which is the traditional business model. I've definitely stayed away from that. In fact, I've turned down some quite big paying offers that I've had, because it didn't resonate with my soul. I want to, if we're going to try and inspire other people, we have to live by example, because the old system was saying one thing and then acting in an entirely different way, and that hasn't worked out so well. So we've got to sort of stay true to our integrity, I think. So that's my kind of approach to it. And I've certainly had some further revelations, you could say, about the sound since last year, because I went back to Egypt just a few months ago.
By all accounts, continue.
Well, in total, I went into the Great Pyramid 6 times, because I went out early to Egypt before our tour starts. Because one of the other reasons I like to be involved with tours is to help the guests get the most out of the opportunity, because I'm fully aware that it might be their one and only chance in this lifetime to visit Egypt or Peru or wherever it may be. So I want to make sure that they get the absolute maximum out of their chance to visit. So it's quite nice if I can go out a few days early before a tour and just sort of acclimatise, spend a bit of time researching with my Egyptian friends and getting myself ready for the tour. And so we went into the Great Pyramid a number of times. And I shared a photograph on Facebook recently, and Stephen Meller, who I'm sure you know and probably your listeners have heard of, it was about the antechamber, which is at the top of the Grand Gallery, just before the King's Chamber. And on the wall of the antechamber is this kind of, well, you've got blocks of stone sticking out, and then it's cut in, and then there's another block sticking out, and then it's cut in. And so I posted this photograph of the antechamber, and Stephen Meller said, from his sort of conversations with various people, they'd come to the conclusion that it could be some kind of a sound baffle. So I thought, that's interesting, and did a Google search on sound baffles. And what actually came up was a picture of something very, very similar on Google, and actually called it a sound diffuser. So and this is on the wall just as you enter the King's Chamber. So if we sort of follow that line of thought, it appears that they were perhaps trying to stop sound going into the King's Chamber, because from my experimentations with sound in there, you want it to be a completely clean environment. Because of the properties that are in that room, if I say hello loudly in the King's Chamber, you're going to hear at least 5 versions of that hello. It's like a repeated echo gradually getting quieter and quieter. So if there's any sound coming up the Grand Gallery, which is like a huge amplifier, basically, you can hear a step at the bottom of the Grand Gallery in the King's Chamber, which is, was it, about 80 feet away? So I think they were trying to have a completely clean sound environment in the King's Chamber. And one of the things that you can do with the sound in there is you can gradually build up a louder and louder and louder and louder sound, because you can interact with these echoes of sound. So you don't have to produce a continuous tone. You can pulse the sound. And then as long as you time your pulse as the echo hits you, you can just keep amplifying and amplifying and amplifying. And I've had some very interesting experiences with that. I'm certainly drawn to the idea that perhaps Walter was somehow involved in these monuments. There seems to be various signs pointing us in that direction. And one of the areas of research I'm now looking into is what I would call natural technologies, how our ancient ancestors lived in harmony with the environment and used the environmental energy sources like water and sound and perhaps earth energies, and somehow integrated these and amplified them at various structures that they've marked around the planet.
And kind of going one step further, what do you think people built these pyramids for? What is it about them that, you know, you think they were built for? What purpose did they serve? What kind of effect were they supposed to have on the people inside?
Well, this is the kind of difficult part, because the Great Pyramid, from the architecture, would seem to serve a few purposes, I would say. But what I'm trying to do is base my own research on my experiences, because otherwise everything's subjective. It could have been this, it could have been that. So what happens when Gary goes into the Great Pyramid's King's Chamber? And that's all I can really say for sure. I went in one state of consciousness. We've interacted with sound. I mean, sometimes when we came out of the Great Pyramid, my friend and I felt so light that we could walk on air, and there was a real joy in our heart and a sort of light-hearted attitude, and we were very happy. So, I mean, that's never a bad state of being. I'd quite like to be in that frame of mind every day. So that's kind of one aspect of it, but there's certainly a much, much deeper aspect that we're looking for, because what happens in life when we have difficulties, I mean, it's quite a difficult journey for all of us on the material plane, and that so that when we get hurt or something happens to us, we tend to hold on to trauma, and that trauma can prevent us from doing things in the future. And as a result of the experiences I've had in Egypt, I no longer have, I would say, the fear of death that I had. I've been shown enough to know that this physical existence isn't all there is, and that there's other levels of consciousness that we would go to afterwards. So this, you can certainly get that as one effect of visiting these sites. I always say that there's a thinning of the veil at some of these powerful places. And by that I mean we're able to access, you could say, your intuition. Some people might prefer to think of it as higher self, and then other people perhaps would say guides. But I prefer to think of it as intuition. We don't need to look outside of ourselves for answers. So by going to these sites and accessing our intuition, we can then get a clearer insight perhaps into why we've come here, what we want to do with our lives. A lot of the people that come on the tours perhaps at the start or the middle of their sort of journey or their spiritual quest, they're in the corporate world like I was, and I used to feel very depressed because I knew there was something more to life and I wanted to be helping people. And by going to these sites, perhaps you can gain insights into what you really want to do, what's going to make you come alive and love life.
Well, and I was going to say the other thing is that so many of these monuments have been linked with death and ancestor worship. Do you think that is something which is a misnomer, or do you think that there is something to this, specifically because you're kind of like highlighting that the veil seems to be thinner? Was contact with that other realm part of the experience, you think, or where do you stand on that?
It's a subject that we discuss quite a lot on science. At the various places. I mean, the academics, when you walk around the British Museum, they've basically got about three explanations for every object. It's going to be religious, ceremonial, and sort of burial objects. And so I think they've definitely perhaps looked at the last evidence that they found at the site and then labelled the site as a burial chamber. There's a few that we visit in Wiltshire. I tend to try and look past that aspect of a lot of these sites. And I'm sure that there's certainly plenty of burial chambers, and it's very easy to try and put something spurious on something that's legitimately a burial chamber. So you certainly need to be careful that you're not pushing your own sort of thoughts or ideas onto something wrongly. So I am conscious of that. But I think there's certainly, these sites were significant from a very early time. And because there's such a huge span of time that they've been co-opted later on, so over hundreds or thousands of years, people still going to the sites, and then perhaps towards the end of their functional lifetime, people have started burying the dead and then closed them up, because we've certainly got lots of megalithic sites that have been buried and closed. But what was its original purpose? And I've certainly been shown lots of evidence for that in Egypt, where various pharaohs have come along, carved their name on something, and then the Egyptologists will say, "Ah, well, Ramesses the Second built it," because his name's everywhere. But he was either a very busy boy, or he just had a good cast of stonemasons going around putting his name on everything.
He had a good PR department.
Yeah, perhaps I was back then as well.
Which is your favorite site? Which site features extremely high, or which sites feature extremely high on your wish list of sites with acoustic capabilities which you want to tick off?
Well, the Great Pyramid was certainly the start of it all, and there is one site in Peru that we haven't discussed yet that's also very interesting from a kind of energetic perspective. But yeah, certainly the Great Pyramid. I was actually going to give your listeners a little list of my top Egyptian sites that I've managed to tune into and always are very special to me.
By all accounts, do.
So that would be the Great Pyramid, number one. And then probably the next one, which is very close to my heart and I just can't spend enough time there, is Luxor Temple. I've never actually visited there in the daytime, but we always go at night when it's all lit up in these wonderful lighting. And because the tourist industry has been so affected since the revolution in February 2011, quite often when we've gone there at night, we've had the place either to ourselves, apart from the guards, or almost to ourselves with just a few groups coming in. Because as you mentioned earlier, I mean, your kind of typical tour group is turn up at the Great Pyramid, they jump out of the coach, they run up to the base of the Great Pyramid, get their camera out, take a few pictures of the Great Pyramid, or take a few pictures of themselves in front of the Great Pyramid, and then I see them, they go back to the coach, and then they drive off to the next site. And, I just feel sad. I mean, we've all got our different paths, and I'm sure things happen when people need them. But when I know that there's just such a magical place waiting for them inside, it is a bit heartbreaking from that perspective. And as you mentioned, the problem with looking at these sites through a camera lens, which is something that my yoga teacher tuned me into, what we want to be doing in nature as well, but megaliths excites, it's certainly very important, is to be expanding our level of awareness and consciousness. So by pushing your focus into this tiny screen, which is just an inch or two across, that's actually the opposite to what you really want to be doing if you've gone to the sites to experience them. If you're going there to photograph them and that's what you're happy with, then by all means. But if you're going to megalithic sites in Egypt because you want to experience something a little bit different to the normal daily life, then my advice would be go to them, take some photographs when you arrive, give yourself a nice opportunity for however long your group's there or you would want to stay, just to tune in, meditate if that's your kind of thing, but just be peaceful and walk amongst them and see what you feel. And then once you think that you've had enough of that, take your video or photographs, and that kind of approach means that you can get your mementos, because we certainly all want to remember these amazing places, because they certainly speak to my soul. But then we've also given ourselves the opportunity to experience them as well.
Absolutely. What's the site in Peru which you didn't mention yet?
Well, one of the big reasons I wanted to go to Peru was because of the doorway of a Marimuru close to Lake Titicaca, which is commonly known as a stargate in the alternative world, which is quite a big claim to make. I mean, if you call something a stargate to your normal scientist, they'd probably either run or call you names.
I believe some of them have broken the world record high jump when they are confronted with it.
Yeah, so, but it's certainly got a big reputation, and a lot of the people I know and the authors I admire have spoken about it as an amazing site. So I was very keen to go there and experience it myself. And it just so happened that the tour I was on sort of coincided with the time of 11/11/11. And this site, I mean, we visited it a few times. One time there was nobody there. Another time that there was just a small handful of people kind of taking part in a shamanic ritual of some kind. But on 11/11/11, there was about 300 or 400 people that turned up. So that there was just coach after coach after coach of people turning up. Majority of them were dressed in white. I wasn't aware that was going to be the case, so I wasn't in white. And I have to say, yeah, it was quite a moving experience. The intention that the shaman was working with was to kind of welcome these new energies onto the planet, because of the date significance to him. I'm a little bit sceptical, because our calendars have been sort of interfered with over the ages, so I'm not too sure how those kind of things line up now. But 300 to 400 people getting together with a positive attitude, well, I don't think that can be a bad thing. And it was, yeah, it was a very nice experience. But we had been to the site previous to 11/11/11, and so I was very keen to go there and see what I could feel in comparison to the other sites that I'd visited. And if your listeners aren't aware, the door, what they call the doorway of a Marimuru, is, I would estimate, it's like a doorway that's been cut into a huge part of the mountain face, and it's about 20 feet, perhaps you know better than I, 20 feet tall and 15, 20 feet across on the outer part, with a small inner doorway to it, which is not quite as tall as me, because I had to crouch down. So it's probably about 5.5 feet tall. And that's actually like a door that you would have in your house, but a little bit smaller, but it doesn't actually go anywhere physically. So it's an interesting challenge, because doorways normally go somewhere. So why has somebody cut a doorway into a mountain face? Is there some other way to access the doorway, is the question that it begs. So when we go to these temples, I try to walk through barefooted, because a lot of the time we're walking around with training shoes on our feet, which are basically like rubber insulators. But when you take your shoes and socks off, you can actually feel something quite often through your feet, which are, of course, very sensitive, because they're normally covered. So they're a good place to sense energy from at megalithic sites. And that is something that I encourage other people to do. We've had some very interesting results. I've had a lot of people thank me for that advice. And it's certainly been a key part to tuning in to these amazing places. And the energy at the doorway, wow, it was absolutely incredible. Certainly up there with the Great Pyramid. I mean, the King's Chamber, when I've done the same thing, is about the only fair comparison that I could make at this point. But it was so strong that when my friend and I left the site, these other two people that were in our group were in the same sort of state of consciousness as they entered, I would say, the kind of logical problem-solving state of consciousness, as Graham Hancock would call it. But I could see right away that myself and my friend, we were chattering away as if we'd had sort of 15, 20 cups of coffee, and that lasted for sort of 2 or 3 hours. We were really kind of wired, you could say. So it had a very, very powerful effect, and it was also reproducible when we returned to the site as well. So it's a good place to recharge your batteries, the doorway of Amarimuru.
Well, thank you, Gary, for charging our batteries, and specifically on so many levels. I think you've offered great travel advice, if anything, for how people should visit some of these sites. And specifically, I hope that you have encouraged others to join what I would call as an experiment of sound, of approaching these things with the sound perspective in mind as well. And as you say, you definitely get results simply by becoming part of that site, and the better you become at it, the greater the experience will be.
Definitely. I did have one last message I would like to share, if that's possible.
Absolutely.
Well, I was just going to say, because I have the opportunity to book people in for a variety of tours, it has caught my notice that people feel called to these ancient sites. I've noticed a pattern where there's more to it than just I would like to go on holiday to Egypt. Egypt, the Great Pyramid, and these places, I think there's something going on a very deep, perhaps a subconscious level, and they do call people to them. And so Egypt's not going to be the answer for everybody. We all do need something different for our progress. I understand that much. But if you feel called to an ancient site around the planet, or have been interested in these places, I would certainly encourage people to visit if they're able to, because it might just change their life, like I feel it has done for me.
Absolutely. There is no way like experiencing a site. And I make it a point that if I ever write about a subject, then unless it's something very mundane, I will always go there before ever writing anything about it. And that's absolutely the approach which Kathleen and I take, and which we have been talking about, in fact, a couple of weeks ago, about how being on a site completely changes the approach. But unfortunately, Gary, this is where we will have to stop at this moment in time, because we have reached the end of this show. But if people want to see you live in person, they will probably do so at a number of conferences where you will be. But in the near future, you're going to be in Oregon, I believe.
Yes, that's right. I'm going to be visiting the ranch of James Gilliland, and people should be able to find out some details about that on the eSETI website soon.
And so that is where you will be able to find Gary soon. We have come to the end of this episode of The Spirit Revolution. If you want to hear this episode again, any other of our previous episodes, there are a number of ways of doing so. TheSpiritRevolution.com is one place. BBSRadio.com, where you can listen to all of our shows' archives for a small fee. And you just do not get us, but you also get several of the other shows which are aired on the two channels of BBS Radio. And you can also go on iTunes, where for free you can download more than a year and a half of our shows. Until, however, the next week, from the both of us, even though it was just myself this week, the truth against the world.